welcome to A Little Less Conversation, a podcast series on how Australia is addressing climate change as a function of our international development program. I'm Rachel Mason-Nunn, founder of Goodwill Hunters and director with Mandala Partners.
And I'm Dermot O'Gorman, CEO of WWF Australia. This series is a collaboration between Goodwill Hunters, WWF, and the Australian Council for International Development, ACFID.
Climate change is the stormy undercurrent to our daily lives here in Australia, but in many of the countries we work in as development practitioners, it's a loud and urgent drumbeat. To do development effectively, it's increasingly glaringly obvious that addressing climate change needs to be front and centre. To that end, we're holding the microphone out to those willing to take on the sometimes vexed challenge of speaking to Australia's climate change and development goals, where they intersect and where they deviate, as well as profiling innovative themes and ideas.
One of the issues that has always been a topic of conversation in climate is around the two terms of mitigation versus adaptation. They're often linked to show how we approach climate change and where do we spend our energies trying to address the root causes of climate change, or do we work on the strategies to help us adapt?
Perhaps the most common analogy is that of a leaky boat. If you're in it, do you first try to scoop the water out, or do you try to fix the hole? This episode will seek to answer that and more. With us today, we have Salah George Carter, who is a research fellow in geopolitics and regionalism at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, who focuses on Pacific Island states and people's influence in decision-making processes. And Lisa Viliamu-Jameson, who is a Samoan-Australian community campaigner and creative producer. She's an organiser for the Queensland Pacific Climate Warriors and a campaigner for 350 Australia, which is working to move Australia beyond fossil fuels. Lisa currently campaigns for the landmark Torres Strait climate justice case, Our Islands, Our Home. George and Lisa, welcome. And can you tell us where you are?
Tala for everyone. It's so great to join you today. I'm joining you from the Rock of Polynesia, Niue Island from the village of Namakulu. My name is Lisa Viliamu-Jameson. I'm a campaigner, a curator, a writer, and I'm also a mum. And I'm so happy to be here to share space with George, my Samoan brother. If you wanted to share where you are, George.
Talofalava, Māori, greetings everyone. This is George Carter. I'm actually here in Dubai at the expo for where we are attending the Conference of the Parties, so the negotiations under the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. So we're here for the next two to three weeks. And I'm actually, well, I'm from Samoa, of Tuvalu, Samoan, Kiribati, British and Chinese ancestry. Part of my work, both as a researcher, but also an advisor in terms of climate change negotiations in the area of gender, youth, Indigenous peoples for the Pacific, where I collaborate with the Secretariat Pacific Regional Environmental Program, another program called One Crop, where it's a group of regional advisors that supports the 14 countries here at the negotiations. And I'm actually, because my role is as the key lead in the gender and climate change, I support the political champion who is from Niue, the Honourable Minister Mona Ainu'u. And so I'm here as a delegate of Niue in these meetings. It's a pleasure to be here and looking forward to our talanoa.
Thank you, George, and thank you, Lisa. Well, look, you are living on a day, week, and yearly basis this sort of tension between mitigation and adaptation. So I wanted to hear from both of you. What are your thoughts on this? Maybe, Lisa, would you like to go first?
Yeah, great. Look, I'm a big believer in keeping language simple and accessible, so I'll try not to use climate movement jargon or technical terms. But this is how I interpret mitigation and adaptation. So also very visual person, but for me, an example of adaptation would be building seawalls to help slow down erosion for islands that are facing rising sea levels. So it's a temporary solution that's very necessary, very important. So that's adapting to the change in climate, but it's not necessarily addressing the root issue that contributes significantly to the warming of our planet. And so you can compare adaptation to a Band-Aid solution where an amputation is actually medically needed. And so what we actually need to do is sever our ties to the fossil fuel industry. Pacific Islanders have been leading and championing the call for a phase out from the fossil fuel industry and a just transition to renewable energy. So for me, it's important to address mitigation and adaptation. I hope I covered everything that you asked then. Sorry, damn it. I got too caught up in my analogies.
So analogies are great. And look, we'll come back to that fossil free Pacific because I think it's a really important example about Pacific leadership that you talked about. But I might now go to George. George, big picture, that mitigation, adaptation, how do you see that playing out? You're at COP, you're going to see that every day. What's your thoughts?
Yes, so very simple. And also as an educator, how do I describe this mitigation adaptation to my students? But also how it's played out here at the COP. So that's also my reference point. So I just explain it in a way of behavior. Mitigation is the ability to address the cause. And for adaptation is the ability to adapt or live with the changes. So when we talk about climate change, mitigation is where we are trying to address the cause. And we all know that the science has said this for the last over 40 years. In fact, even the last 100 years, science have said that the cause of the global warming that we are living in is because of the increasing greenhouse gas emissions that comes from the pollution from the industries that have sort of made our lives a little bit easier. So that's what mitigation is about here at the global negotiations. It's our ability to restrain our behavior as human beings or as states to try and find ways to cut greenhouse gas emissions. Well, in fact, the language here at the conference is to stabilize greenhouse gas emissions. And on the other end, adaptation. Adaptation is our ability to adapt to the effects of climate change, whether it be sea level rise, ocean acidification, increasing droughts. We are trying to find solutions to live with these changes. Now, another way to also differentiate mitigation and adaptation, and we're at the heart of negotiation, is that mitigation requires a global response. It's not just Samoa or Niue that cuts their emission. It's not just Australia that cuts emission. We need a global response. Hence why the platform of these negotiations is fundamentally, these are important for us to create a global consensus to drive behavior of states and their companies and their CEOs and people to cut emissions or stabilize emissions. On the other hand, we need solutions that are local. And that's the other conundrum of negotiations is you want a global response to a mitigation to address the cause, but we also need differentiated solutions that appeal, that are fit within the context of Siberia, within the context of Niue, within the context of Aotearoa. And that's what happens here in these negotiations. Big solutions, but we also need individualized solutions that are contextualized. And we also have a financial system that sort of drives these two things, and that's what climate finance is. It's about we need a global response, have a pool of funding, but we need that funding to trickle all the way down to local communities. At the moment, we have this fundamental problem that it sucks within the national, within the only nations can apply for funding and it doesn't trickle down. So hopefully that explanation not only describes it's about the behavior, but also how it then sort of scales up to the negotiations that happen within a conference of the parties.
Yeah, thanks, George. And thanks, Lisa, for that explanation. I feel when we're talking about mitigation and adaptation, it's often phrased as though we have a choice. You can mitigate or you can adapt. But I wonder, at what point do we say we failed to mitigate in time, now we must simply adapt? Like, have we crossed that line already, George?
We have been adapting, not just Pacific countries. Australians have been adapting to the bushfires. Communities in Russia have been adapting. It's part of who we are. But we say in the Pacific, the impacts of climate change are worsening. In fact, IPCC says it's catastrophic. We're getting extreme. We are facing an impact with the El Nino season. We should be seeing more impact of more, not only frequent, but extreme weather events. So people have been adapting. In fact, 50,000 years ago, 1,500 years ago, when the first and second wave of voyagers came to the Pacific, they were adapting not only to the environment, but also to the harsh remoteness of the islands, the resources. So adaptation is always part of Pacific or island psyche or drive. What's happening now is that the changing climate has made it much, we need to do a little bit more than what we've been used to. And this has seen that economies are having to borrow more money to rebuild after more frequent disasters. Communities are having to rebuild. Although their resilience is strong in terms of adapting and they know how to adapt after every cyclone, but that's not what it's supposed to be. On the other flip side, if we're talking about the Pacific, in total, less than 1% or just above 1% of the global greenhouse gas emissions come from this part of the world. So there's very much little to address in terms of the cause. However, there are certain, you know, a majority of where there are greenhouse gas emissions from the Pacific. It's in the transportation sector and the energy sector. But these are very small roads. But in terms of mitigation, where a lot of the drive from the Pacific come through, it's not necessarily cutting their emissions because we don't have much to cut, but it's the transition to renewable energy, where our energy sectors throughout the islands are almost 80% dependent on fossil fuel for energy. So that's another part of the equation. So as I said, on one side, it's about we have been adapting to these green impacts like sea level rise. We are also coming to the part where we say we can no longer adapt, and that's what loss and damage is the inability of society or human beings to adapt. So once water has taken over your land, you can't adapt to that land. You've lost that land forever. That's what loss and damage is. And so where we say and argue that part of that impact is where communities or villages will have to, they are displaced and have to move inland. That's what's happening in Fiji. And now we're talking about international displacement, where people are thinking or policies are now being, they're designing policies where it allows people to migrate to different countries. That's because it's the foresight, but also the thinking that we're coming to a point where we can no longer adapt. So that's another part of adaptation. Yeah.
Thanks, George. I think that's a good explanation. Lisa, I'd be interested in how you would illustrate and contextualize this in Niue. Is it still a choice between mitigation and adaptation there?
I think for me, I'd like to contextualize this based on the Torres Strait, just because I've done extensive work there in the past few years. And the islands that I work with are very, very small, like in comparison to Niue. So Marsig Island, which is between Papua New Guinea and the tip of Australia, it's 2.8 kilometres long, 800 metres wide. We're talking about tiny, tiny islands. So for them, the community's been creating their own makeshift seawalls. They've been using coconut fronds and like pieces of wood to try protect the edges of their island. And, you know, for some of the islands there, like Purama, it's taken them 20 years to actually get some funding to build some seawalls, and they've lost significant amounts of land mass there. So they've been adapting over the years. For decades, they've been calling for more funding for seawalls, but it's not nearly enough to stop what's happening. They, you know, if you tell them, oh, maybe we should just adapt and don't worry about like mitigation, it's a slap in the face for them, for community on the ground, for community at a grassroots level. You know, I've actually seen people pick up ancestors' bones like from these shorelines and made a commitment that, you know, we're not just going to get seawall funding, we're going to try get to the heart and the cause of this issue. And it's beyond mitigation, it's beyond like Australia approving 26 new mines this year. It's about these systemic issues and systems of oppression that are really affecting people on the front lines. So for me, I think there's no point where we go, oh, you know what, don't worry about mitigation. I think the science at the moment is telling us like there can be an increase in temperature from 2.5 degrees to 4 degrees. And I think we just need to build power on the ground and continue to hold like nations like Australia accountable, because these terms adaptation, mitigation, it just becomes like I said, like jargon and negotiating in rooms, when the reality for many people is that they just want to continue as they have lived, their families have lived for generations and thousands of years, but they're forced to be a part of these conversations.
Lisa, that's great. And I really like the sort of clarity that you bring to that. Yeah, you're right. Putting it in a mitigation adaptation box makes it sound technical, but picking up bones, your ancestors' bones, is something that nobody, wherever you live in the world, ever wants to do. And I think it's something that leads me on to this next question, which is, you talked a little bit about earlier about the fossil fuel free Pacific, and you know the Port Billet call or declaration came out earlier this year. Can you tell us a little bit about the Pacific's ambition or really strong action?
Yeah, I'm so proud of our Pacific Island leaders and region. They are truly the climate leaders in terms of like leading the way. So earlier this year in March, several Pacific Island nations met in Port Vila in Vanuatu, and they made a commitment to phase out fossil fuels as rapidly as possible. The signatories included Tonga, Fiji, Niue, Solomon Islands, Tuvalu, and Vanuatu. And at the time, they acknowledged that earlier in the year, the cyclones that had been devastating the region, they felt were fossil fuel-induced loss and damage. And they also agreed to establish a Pacific Energy Commissioner for a just transition to a fossil fuel-free Pacific. So to me, that's like George mentioned, the contribution to carbon emissions from the Pacific region is just so minimal in comparison to nations like Australia. And the fact that our leaders are committing to stopping the expansion of the fossil fuel industry just shows that, you know, they're doing their part. And I feel like for me, I'm not as articulate as my brother here, George, and I feel like I might not have done justice in explaining the significance of the Port Vila call to action. So if he wants to expand on it, please do, George.
Sure. I mean, I won't talk about in terms of the campaign itself, but just to give context around what I think the idea of the fossil fuel treaty campaign. I mean, this is basic common sense. In the world where fossil fuels have and are a cause of global greenhouse gas emissions in terms of the industry, part of the behavior and what we all now agree to and have a consensus is on that we need to stop using greenhouse gas emissions. So it is a cause for any of the parties that have signed up to UNFCCC is that we all agree to the fact that we need to cut, minimize, or stop using fossil fuels because they link. So although, like, for example, Australia has not signed up to the treaty, it has said and it supported it in the Pacific Island Forum communique, but also in its rhetoric globally, that we need to stop using greenhouse gas emissions, fossil fuel. Even here in UAE, we know that this is a cause of a statement by leaders here say, we know that this is, leads to greenhouse gas emissions, but let's try and, as the language goes, phase it out. Phase it down, not phase it out, phase it down. And so what the treaty is all about and the campaign is accelerating that behavior that we need to look at industries or develop industries that does not need to use fossil fuel so that we remove our dependency as human beings or as states using this technology, using this fuel for technology. And what the treaty is all about is having that global commitment. It's something that we all know as human beings is the right thing to do. Like smoking, we just need a treaty to accelerate. And that's what the campaign that the countries like Tuvalu, Tonga, Vanuatu have started. And it will pick up. Although this year may be going very slow with three or four countries, it will pick up. Just as how the climate change treaty came about in 1992, it started in the 1980s when scientists were saying, you need to cut your greenhouse gas emissions because of the global warming. And it took a four-year campaign that took countries like Tuvalu, like Australia, to push it through the Commonwealth, to push it through the United Nations in the late 1980s, to get a UN resolution by 1990, that by 1992, there was a climate change treaty. It's part of that. We know it's wrong for us. We need to do something about it. And these are some diplomatic actions that are happening. Just as how we say we need to stop smoking, the smoking industry, it takes treaties and campaigns. And that's my understanding and my explanation to people of what the fossil fuel. We all know it, and we need to stop our dependency on fossil fuel, transition our economy, transition our industries, and the treaty just helps us to accelerate that and sends triggers not only to the private sector, but also to communities as well.
George, can I just follow up on that? WWF was a very early sign up to the Port Vila Declaration as a global NGO. And I've been very encouraged by the global response to the Pacific leadership on this around the world. But let's bring it back to Australia. What do you think it would take Australia to answer the Port Vila call and to support a fossil fuel non-proliferation treaty?
First of all, it's the way that Australia looks, my understanding in terms of our policy, climate change policy, since Orients, we have the science. We have the best science there is in the world that tell us. We are, our communities are suffering from the bushfires. Our coral reefs are dying in the north, in terms of ocean acidification. We are impacted in Australia. But part of our policy formulation in Australia is the fact that it's also about the economy. Right? And we need policies, in fact, we need governments that can take risks in terms of investing in renewable energy or investing in research that we can see or find in Australia, energy that's moving away from coal and fossil fuel. Because at the moment, the economy is very much dependent on coal, and the mining sector, right? And that's because the investment for the last, 50 years has been in that sector. And everyone has been calling in, everyone in terms of NGOs, academics have said, we need to divest. The government needs to send signals that we need to move forward. Like it's what's happening in Europe. We are almost 15 to 20 years behind the way that Europe is moving. In terms of their transition, it's balancing their energy consumption that both uses fossil fuel, but also renewable energy. And of course, they also have nuclear. But that's part of the transition. It won't be done overnight. And that's what we need in Australia, is governments that are bold and take risks to push the direction, and so that community says, yes, we can live with renewable energy. We need to take it on. I mean, the debate about nuclear, that's another bigger community and national dialogue and conversations that need to happen. But it's obviously clear we need that move away in terms of where the economy, and once that, I mean, it can happen now, but as the economy becomes comfortable in that transition and communities are able to do that, we can see also more accelerated drive. So it's that we have science, but we really need to also have that investment in research, have that investment in technology, and have that investment where our society in Australia is saying, yes, we need to move forward in this area.
Lisa, I mean, you're obviously working on this all the time. So we need the science, we need the investment in the transition, we need to in Australia.
Yeah, for me, it's all about our everyday heroes rising up. So communities on the ground, building power from the people to really put pressure on our government. Because to be honest, I think Australia just, even with this new government, just likes to talk the talk, but not walk the walk. Climate action to them is a big like PR campaign. And so they like to appear as though they're taking as much action as they can. And, you know, at the same time, like I mentioned, they're approving new mines all the time, like 26 new mines this year. So for me, it means, you know, everyday people needing to hold MPs accountable, putting pressure on them, you know, people who are sitting on the sidelines, quite passive, being more active and understanding the urgency of the situation. You know, one of my favorite activists, Brianna Fruin, who's a Samoan sister of mine, she mentions this analogy, and I'm always, like I mentioned, a visual person, but she mentions this analogy of, if you can liken the climate movement to a canoe, and everybody has a position and a role in this canoe, on this whaka. So at the front, you've got your young people, we've got our school strikers on the streets, you know, campaigning, advocating. In the middle, we've got, you know, people in parliament, who government officials who are pushing for renewables and transitioning. We also have, you know, our farmers, we've got our First Nations people, Pacific Island diaspora, this is in terms of the Australian climate context. And then at the back, we've got our elders and our First Nations people really steering the direction of the canoe. What it feels like at the moment is that our government, who are a part of this canoe, are like paddling at a different pace. They're paddling in a different direction to what the majority want. And yeah, just to me, it feels like we absolutely need more urgency.
Yeah, thank you both. I think to change the pace of the conversation a little bit, you both have family in Samoa, and I'd be really keen for our listeners to hear, if you're able to share, a bit about what your families are experiencing day to day in Samoa. Yeah, George, if we could start with you.
What is the daily life of my family in Samoa, and how does climate change impact them? You know, the earliest memories of how my family or my upbringing is impacted by climate change is, you know, as a 5-year-old and again as a 6-year-old, hiding underneath a tarpaulin with 30 other people, with the roof of our home ripped. And because there was no other, we were huddling under that and waiting for the eye of the storm to then allow us to run to another side, to crack open a cement tank, which were in our villages back then, to hide inside that concrete shell to wait for the cyclone to pass, right? During the eye of the cyclone, that's that, you know, 10, 15 minute window where it's peace. I mean, it's calm. You see a sunshine in the middle of that eye of the cyclone. That's the time where it's safe to move and huddle. And that's what we did. I remember that because it not only happened in 1990, it happened again in 1991, around the Christmas times, you know? And so that's something I said, cyclones and hurricanes is something that is normal for us. We live with. Apparently in Australia, there are no cyclones and hurricanes in Canberra where I live. And so the behavior or what we are used to in Samoa is that towards the end of the year, we have to prepare. And because of that life experience of the roof of your house being ripped off and having to recover and rebuild. In fact, we were displaced. Our family decided at that end to move away from our businesses in the rural areas. We had farms, we had shipping ports, we looked after a big trading depot. We lost our income, and so we had to migrate back to, we gave up all of that trading depot to go back into the city and restart again. These are examples of recovering from a cyclone. But it's not just my experience. It's experience of many in Samoa, across the Pacific, and probably the same as communities up in Mackay in Queensland, when there are also cyclones that hit that part of the world. What the science is saying is that it's getting worse, and you will be getting more frequent disasters as well. And that's what is happening and is going to happen in Samoa, as well as Fiji, as well as in Vanuatu, and again in Queensland. And so a lot of our behavior as human beings, but also as communities and states, is attributed not only to the environment, but to the climate. And that's a simple way to explain it to students of how and what living with climate impacts is about. It's having to live with the anticipation, not in fear. It's not to live in fear of the climate, but anticipation that we will have to adapt. And the reality as well, to adapt, you also have to look at the way that we're consuming. In Canberra, one way to explain climate displacement to my students is what happens at the tail end of December and January. There's a huge displacement or migration of Canberrans moving away from Canberra to coastal because it's so hot, right? That's a simple way to also, you know, to live that experience. If you live with the, you know, with aircon, you know, with the comforts of aircon, also be mindful that that energy that you're consuming allows you to live in that space, right? And that's what's going to happen with the climate as it gets worse 50 years in the next 100 years. People will have to move, not only in the Pacific, but also in Australia, because it's going to be getting hotter and increase in heat temperature. We'll have more frequent fires in terms of bushfires. And that we will force us to be displaced. It's not just something that happens in Bangladesh, in Nigeria. It's going to happen in Canberra as well. So we can live in the day and be consumed in the day, and that's what politics is all about. It's the decisions are made is because of the 3 years that they're in politics. But we also need to also have decision makers or politicians that can see forward that we need to have very strong policies to allow us to adapt to what's going to come in the next 50 years. Yeah. Sorry, I started off from a tangent from living in Samoa to my home in Canberra, which is what I do. I mean, I live, yeah.
It was yeah. No, it's great. I think connecting the two is really profound and really well said. Thank you, George. And Lisa, I'd like to turn to you now, but I'd also like to ask you about the Torres Strait. And you shared that harrowing story earlier about the Torres Strait, but if you could tell us a little bit more about your experience working there and what you see amongst communities, that would be great.
Yeah, awesome. For me, like George has mentioned, so he mentioned home for Samoa, Canberra, I also have many homes and connections across the Pacific and now in the Torres Strait. So, but the climate impacts that I've seen in the Torres Strait, yeah, absolutely affecting everyday life for people, not just in terms of like, you know, weather patterns changing and sea level rise and erosion, but just the cultural impacts that, you know, I'm like a Samoan person that was raised in Brisbane. And so for me, like I mentioned, home for me is in many different areas, but somehow I ended up in the Torres Strait. And some of the impacts that I've seen is, you know, impacts on food security, which is how our family is affected in Samoa. My father-in-law is a farmer. And so, you know, for people who live off the land, who require the ability to grow their crops, to feed their families, you know, it's affecting them so much. In the Torres Strait, some of the cultural practices that they do, we do in the Pacific. In Niue, you know, we bury our children's placenta with coconut trees, and there's a ceremonial significance to that. And the idea is that as the child grows up with the coconut tree, the child can rely on that coconut tree for shelter, for food and drink. And there's a really special connection there. And so I brought my son's placenta to Niue. We've planted it on family land. And we actually chose to plant it inland because of, you know, potential cyclones and just trying to protect his coconut tree, my son Tahi's. And they do the exact same thing in the Torres Strait. I've walked past coconut trees that have been, you know, destroyed by saltwater intrusion and harrowing winds, and seen, you know, these places that mark the afterbirth for many of their children have been damaged, have been washed out also with ancestors' bones. So I think, you know, yeah, I, you know, just also just processing George's story of how he grew up and how he, his family had to relocate, and the huge impacts on his family because of experiencing these severe cyclones. Like in Niue, they're still, you know, 20 years later from Cyclone Heta, which devastated Alofi, the town here in Niue, they're still dealing with the impacts of that. Their town was completely destroyed. The hospital was destroyed. The museum with all these cultural artifacts were also lost forever. And if you know Niue, it's like pretty high up. It's not low-lying like the Torres Strait with these small islands. But for Niue, it's high up off the ocean. And the fact that this super cyclone created waves that were able to reach inland and like wash away their hospital, it's just crazy. It's crazy to know that happened. And because of that, to this day, like our family have to choose to build inland. We don't build near the coast. It's too much of a risk. So my husband's village and a lot of his family have relocated. The hospital is now inland. So, you know, these impacts are happening constantly and are more severe, but it's also everyday impacts.
Good. Thanks, Lisa. Now, I might start to wrap up with a question for you each, George, and I'll start with you on two very topical questions. You're at COP28 at the moment, George. There's been a lot of talk about the Pacific and Australia co-hosting a COP31 in 2026. You're at the coalface. You've been involved in COPs for a long time. Good thing that the Pacific and Australia host COP31 and highlight to the world what needs to be done or not.
Absolutely. I'm a key believer in the Australia-Pacific COP. I've also been part of conversations behind the scenes and trying to pull that together and what it would look like. It will not be an easy endeavor in terms of multilateral consensus. The role of the chair, and I'm saying this purely because for academic reasons, it's part of a big research that I'm looking at. So I've explored how small states can push the agenda within global consensus in multilateralism. And that's what the Pacific has been good and is famous and has really drive and accelerate negotiations. But the role of a chair is also fundamentally important in terms of driving ambition. You saw this in terms of how France pushed to get us the Paris Agreement, maybe not with teeth, but with the secret ingredients of loss and damage, of finance, of inputting the agenda on Indigenous people and gender. Without the drive of the presidency, those issues are lost. And that's the opportunity that we have in front of us for Australia and the 14 Pacific Island states. We have the opportunity to really push the global agenda on climate change. Because right now, the hosts have the responsibility of inputting. And part of COP presidency is they can also stall the agenda. And that's what's happening in this year's COP presidency. Everyone's talking about the oil deals that are happening. And that's why country hosts, because you bring all these 156 leaders into your country and you have the ability to have those conversations with them. But you also have the ability to drive global consensus on what the world needs to move into. And so if we have that opportunity as Pacific states and Australia, we can also try and drive the international conversation on climate change. We should also be setting the scene in terms of our examples and our domestic policies. That's what I'm excited for in terms of you can't just host and have nothing to present. We should be there in terms of pushing our target, which is at 43%, to much higher, to 65%. Countries are pushing for targets under 2025. You know, domestically, we need to show the world what that would look like. And Australia has the opportunity to do that if it hosts. We also have the opportunity to show and scale the resilience of local communities, Indigenous peoples, Pacific Islands, in terms of how we are adapting, but also informing them of the particular challenges we have in our communities, as well as the challenges of adaptation in Canberra or the adaptation in Perth Broome. We have the spotlight to tell the world this is the challenges and we need global solutions for this. And so that's, I get passionate about it because it's our opportunity. Yes, there's a lot of me that are like, how can it do that when it has a very bad record? There are other countries here that have even worse records. Yeah? China sets it at 80%, but it wants to push it in 2070, as well as India. Their target is 2060. We need to be pushing targets like what we say in the Pacific. The target should be at peaking at 2025. We have the opportunity to drive that global consensus and the diplomacy. Very excited. But we also know there is still a bit of work and way we need to move forward. And if we have the Pacific pushing the Australian presidency, we could do something that's a little bit better than what the current presidency in UAE is doing. We have the opportunity domestically in Australia to improve our policies. I think we will see a drive in just transition. At the university, I will be thrilled because we will see a curriculum that's not based on adaptation and mitigation, but a curriculum that we're teaching our students. We need to move into just transition. We need better scientists, better engineers developing technology rather than let's go and adapt in the Pacific and let's go and cut our emissions. I think it changes the way that we look at our education curriculum. It sends the signals to the private sector, move into renewable energy. This is where we can learn from what's happening in EU. It's not going to be a fast, but it drives us that way. And then, as I said, last is the ability of the world to learn from the Pacific and local community and Australia. We have a lot of great resilience. When I sit and talk to like at the Pacific gatherings with Indigenous people or even business, you hear You see so much sort of small pockets around Australia. It's the opportunity for us to scale. It's the world learning from this part of the world. Because right now, industries and climate change is driven by EU, the European Union, because they host, they're able to do that. That's why UAE wanted to bring it here. They want their industries to drive this transition, right? But for us, they haven't come to our side of the world. You know, next year we go back to Europe. The following year we go to Brazil so that they can show their industries. But we also need to the opportunity to do it. And I think if the bid is, if the announcement is made and with the bid, there won't be a bid. The announcement will be made that where it will be. I think we have a great opportunity for both Australia and the Pacific Islands.
George, that's a great answer. I'm excited about perhaps two COPs in the Southern Hemisphere back-to-back, Brazil, Pacific, Australia. That's a great Southern Hemisphere agenda.
Thank you both so much for your time today and your insight and so sincerely sharing stories close to your heart. We really appreciate it and it's been great to have you on. We've been Dermot O'Gorman and Rachel Mason-Nunn on the A Little Less Conversation podcast. Tune in again. Thanks and bye for now.